Hi, this is Lex, and welcome to the FinTech Blueprint. It's your podcast about fintech, decentralized finance, digital banking, investing, robo-advice, artificial intelligence, and all the other frontier technology that is transforming financial services. To get more content, like an illustrated transcript of this conversation in your inbox, subscribe at fintechblueprint.com. So without further delay, let's jump into today's episode. Hi, everybody, and welcome to today's podcast conversation. I'm thrilled to have with us Eric Barbier, who is the CEO of AAA, a payments processor in the crypto space. And Eric is a repeat entrepreneur, having built a really compelling payments business in the past. So I'm really excited to dive into his experience and learn about the kinds of commerce that digital assets are powering today. With that, Eric, welcome to the conversation.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
My pleasure. So let's start off with a bang. What is AAA and what does it do?
So AAA is a crypto payment gateway. So what we're doing is we're helping merchants, mostly e-commerce merchants, to offer to their client the option to get paid with crypto, but without ever touching crypto. What we're doing is that we are locking the rate during the checkout process. So say a merchant is selling a pair of shoes for $100. What we do is we lock this rate, and no matter what is the volatility of the crypto, even during the checkout process, the merchant is guaranteed to receive exactly $100 on their bank account the next day. So it enables merchants to target the 400 million people owning cryptocurrencies without taking any kind of volatility risk, custody risk, or compliance risk.
You started this business in 2017, if I'm right. Can you tell me about how you came to the idea and like what was that early founding moment like?
In my previous startup, a company called Tunes, which doing cross-border payments, we had two issues. The first one is that, and that was an issue our clients had, which were the problem of fraud, the problem of chargebacks. And so when I discovered crypto, I felt, that's interesting. That's a great technology, which is exactly solving that problem. And then the second issue I had is because in the remittance space, everything is pre-funded. We had a lot of working capital, which was trapped in pre-funding with our different counterparties. And so when I discovered crypto with its ability to do real-time settlements, I felt like, yeah, that's the perfect solution for that problem. And so that's how I started to work on the idea of AAA, on how to improve payments through crypto. And back in the days, like crypto was all about speculation and things of this nature. But I felt for me, the real benefit of crypto is around payment.
Your prior business and experience is really impressive. And I want to dig into the scale of that payments network and the complexity of cross-border. But staying with the merchant payments gateway for the moment, can you talk about in the very beginning, like, were you thinking, we're going to take Bitcoin and Litecoin and XRP and sort of these first generation assets and use them for value transfer? Or were you starting to see the dollar pegged assets as kind of the cash in the space, right? So whether it's Tether or USDC, what was your approach to the right settlement currency, I guess, for commerce?
Really, the initial idea was around the traditional crypto assets, Bitcoin, Ethereum, and the likes. And basically, the two use cases we got from merchants, one was people who made a lot of money investing early in crypto and who wanted to spend this crypto. And that's why we had more of a luxury items, people, you know, even buying a flight ticket, but instead of flying economy, they would fly business or something like this. So that was one of the category of end users which we were targeting, or our merchants were targeting. The second one, and back then it was already a use case, we were seeing is like more and more freelancers, web designers, and you know, this kind of type of people, especially in emerging markets, starting to get paid with crypto. So this means they needed to start paying with their crypto that they were earning. And so that was the two first of big use cases. That's how we started.
And when you started to build out the integration network and the merchant network, what was that like? Can you talk about, I guess, both the types of merchants that were interested in accepting this form of payment? What kind of business are they in? What kind of commerce do they do? You know, are they big? Are they small? Can you give us a bit of a profile for where that started? And then once we have a sense of that, maybe we can chat about where it's gone since.
So I've been focusing mostly on the e-commerce merchants, as I mentioned, so not really the physical retail stores. Been targeting mostly of the large merchants, and this is just essentially to be efficient, because it takes as much time to convince a small merchant or a large merchant. And so because crypto will be for still a couple of years, going to be 1 to 10% of their checkout share, you know, I'd rather, in order to make it a decent business, I'd rather focus on the bigger merchants. And so the type of merchants which were pretty reactive at the beginning, we started by more of a people in the gaming area. So we signed up, one of our first clients has been Razer, the gaming company, whether they were selling gaming hardware as well as Razer Gold, which then enables people to buy games or items in games. So there is a very nice overlap of population between gamers and crypto users. So that's why that was one of the first vertical we work with. And more generally, we've been adding more of a digital content type of merchants. And then subsequently came luxury merchants. And you know, one of the big name I can mention is that we're working with Farfetch, which is this luxury marketplace selling globally. So in this case, the items can be like $1,000 to maybe $5,000 type of goods. The last segment has been travel. Again, one of the benefit of crypto payment is the fact that it works very well for cross border. It solves very well the cross border problems that we're seeing. And because the travel industry is pretty high risk in terms of a lot of chargebacks can happen, a lot of fraud there, crypto is perfect because this is shielding them from all those fraud risk.
I want to ask more about product market fit and then the go-to-market motion. And in particular, you know, can you talk about where the company is based and how that's contributed to your ability to go to market? And then maybe, you know, how do you go and approach these merchants? How do you go and sell to them? Like, do you have an enterprise sales team? Is it conferences and events? Like, how do you onboard these merchants? What's the process to do that, to go and get them? You know, is that related to geography at all?
So I started the company in Singapore. I've been based in Singapore for 20 years. We are licensed by the Central Bank of Singapore as a payment institution. So we're licensed for crypto processing, which we call digital payment token. We're also licensed for merchant acquiring as well as money transfer. So we're one of the very few entities licensed in Singapore for crypto. And I've been pretty lucky to have started a business there, because it is, when it comes to regulation, everything is crystal clear. It's the only, I would say, developed jurisdiction in the world having a proper and complete licensing framework for crypto. And that has given us a pretty good seal of approval, especially when we're dealing with other regulated entities like banks and other financial institutions. On your question of the go-to-market strategy, so we have our strategy is twofold. We're going direct to merchants, and usually the bigger merchants, and that's the traditional B2B sales, like through LinkedIn, trade shows, the way business has been done for a while in the B2B space. And then our second strategy, because everything we do is fully white labeled, is that we're enabling payment service providers. So, typically companies who are already offering credit card processing, they might offer Alipay, WeChat, different wallet option. We enable them to white label our tech and offer it to their existing merchants. So this means that with one integration, I can have access to many merchants at one go. So that's why we're having this both direct and indirect strategy.
What's the traction been like? Obviously, since 2017, the markets have been very volatile in both directions. The regulatory openness and conservatism has swung back and forth. People have had fortunes made, fortunes lost, and the banks have invited the industry in and then cut it off, invited in again, and cut it off again. From my perspective, commerce that is enabled or settled through blockchain rails makes a ton of sense, but often the story is kind of buried behind the capital markets and speculation story. Can you talk about, anything you can share, whether it's customer growth, wallets, volumes, or any signs of adoption? Like, how should people from the outside think about the pitch of using crypto assets for e-commerce?
So on our side, we've seen more and more adoption. So we've not been affected by the so-called crypto winter. Our volumes have been growing. If I look at year on year, we're probably around four to five times. So huge growth. What I can tell you as well is obviously the stable coins have been growing a lot. USDT, USDC have been also growing a lot. We've seen as well more and more B2B use cases being reality. Any kind of business. So we're working with a couple of law firms in Singapore and some of their clients, they want to pay them with crypto. We're having an accounting company in Dubai, for instance, doing the same. So a telecommunication company in Switzerland, also some of their clients wants to pay them with crypto, and that's what we facilitate. So that's some of the new trends we've been seeing. I'll be transparent. We're also seeing some headwinds because of the negative news flow in the press. It has been more difficult to reach out to some of the very big brands, which are a bit more conservative, saying, hey, should I associate my name with crypto? So that's some of the pushback we've been seeing, I would say, since the FTX issue. But the fundamental is that we're seeing more and more people getting paid in crypto, so that they need to spend in crypto. So I think we've reached really the ecosystem is big enough to grow by itself, and we're in this positive cycle.
Let's geek out a little bit on the way the product works. I think from the outside, the user experience is just, okay, well, now in my shopping cart, I have a way to use my digital assets. And you've mentioned that you are licensed in a variety of ways with the monetary authority. Can you talk about like the wiring, the stack? Like, what do you do yourself and what do you need others to do? Do you do the custody? Where does the FX risk go? Do you take it on yourself? Do you underwrite it? Or, is there a broker-dealer partner, somebody like FX Hash? Talk about all the wiring and the piping for the product to work, including, both into the crypto world as well as into the traditional finance world.
We have our own liquidity pool, so which we are tapping on as much as possible. And because here I've only been talking about our crypto payment product, but we also have the other direction, which is our crypto payout. So in this case, a company would give us fiat, dollars, euro, whatever, and then we would be processing on their behalf payments to their freelancers or vendors, or even, we're starting to process payments. We're processing payments for a live streaming app. It's not TikTok, but a smaller one called Bigo Live. And you have live streamers and they're earning some money. And now they have the option to get paid with crypto. And so we power that. So this means that we have both flows coming in. So we're tapping on our own liquidity as much as possible. And when we need more, then we're working with other liquidity partner, which can be OTC or centralized exchanges. That's this piece.
Like, how big do you need a liquidity pool? You know, and this isn't in the sense of like a DeFi liquidity pool, but in the sense of like you're taking on essentially the risk of currency fluctuations. How big do you need it to be relative to the transaction volume? You know, so for every 10 million of transactions, let's say, how much do you need on your own balance sheet to be able to process it in the way that is acceptable to merchants and others?
Oh, so for the merchants, it's totally transparent. So it's more like, what is the risk I'm taking? So I would typically keep on my balance sheet around 5 to 10% of the daily flow, which is going on. So basically, my treasury team's guidance is to keep obviously as little crypto as possible, but still being able to meet the need of our clients. So there's a bit of an art of being able to forecast how much is going to be needed from our clients.
Gotcha. And how do you think about that from an accounting perspective? Is it just a cost of the business, I guess, to be able to create that seamless experience that you sometimes absorb the currency volatility? Or do you think of it as this is a profit center?
No, for now, it's a cost and it's a risk. In my P&L, I really put that below my EBITDA, because sometimes I make money, sometimes I lose money. And this is something, you know, which I don't recognize in my revenues. The thing we're starting to work on is how to hedge this risk. How do we neutralize this risk by covering it through option? Obviously, options have a cost, but that's part of the thing we can improve to reduce this risk to the business. So I don't see it as a cost, but more as a risk, because, and which is linked to the market and not linked to our performance.
And I guess just from, I don't know if it's a regulatory or infrastructure perspective, like when somebody, let's say, pays in Bitcoin or Ether to you, what happens? You know, they send it into some omnibus account that you control, and then you send a different currency from an account to the merchant? Or, you know, how does it work? Is there custody involved on anyone's behalf?
No, we're not custody. There's no custody for most instances. We may have a couple of exceptions, but by default, 99% of my merchants, they don't want to touch, hold, be exposed to crypto. So what we do is we settle to them in US dollar or euros or pounds, whatever they want. We're not a custodian of their crypto assets. So automatically, as soon as we receive the crypto from their client, this becomes an automatic liability to our merchants in fiat.
Cool. Okay. I interrupted you as you were describing the connectivity to the banking sector.
Yeah. So as you allude to, you know, banks is one of the most complex and where we have, yeah, the biggest risk for the business, because obviously we need to have, we're relying on the banks to do the actual last mile settlement. And so that's why the fact that we are regulated, that we have a very strong compliance program, has been helpful in convincing banks and other financial institutions to work with them. But it's obvious that each time we work with a new bank, we have to go through an enhanced due diligence, and they're really, you know, going deep into how we handle the KYC, how do we make sure that the crypto originating from dark web or scam or even worse, which can be OFAC connected to OFAC listed sanction. How do we deal with that? How do we make sure all this activity is being stopped, flagged, reported to the authority? And so we have a very strong and comprehensive compliance framework to deal with that.
Do you use third-party providers to do those know your transaction checks? And then is that difficult to do across multiple chains?
We're using different vendors. We're using Elliptic and Scorechain. Because one of the challenge in our case, and that's why it took us a while to find the right vendors, is that we need to have a real-time information, a real-time result when in an e-commerce transaction. So, you know, you can't ask the user to wait in front of the screen for this to happen. That's why the tools which we're using have to be able to provide us with a real-time information. There's always a lot of fine-tuning on those tools. Those tools are great, but they are not always perfect. To give you an example, there was a lot of complexity when OFAC put Tornado Cash on their list. That created a lot of issues, and those tools took a bit of a while to adjust to that, making sure that, you know, if a transaction happened before it was listed, we should still have a go, and so on. And because, you know, treating with OFAC is really specific, you need, because you probably need to freeze the assets and so on, there's this other type of money laundering risk. You know, it's very important to have those tools correctly set up, and that those tools also react. And as you know, we're in the whole crypto space is moving so quickly. So we need to make sure that we're in line with what regulation is doing.
One kind of key question for the space is whether or not there can really be penetration into commerce at broad scale. Like, there's crypto native commerce where people are buying NFTs and digital objects made by DAOs, right? There are kind of one level up real world goods, like the ones being sold in e-commerce merchants like you describe, that are accepting payment over crypto rails, but the goods themselves are, you know, either physical or digital, but not attached to any sort of chain. And then there is the broader world of commerce with Apple Pay and point of sale terminals and lots of other things that people do. Do you have in mind a picture of how your business as well as the industry moves to encompass more commercial activity? What is the path to expand? And then is there a natural limit on what markets and sectors are available to it?
One market, I think it's still way too early, is point of sales. That's why I've been focusing on the e-commerce, because I think the user experience is still a bit too clunky. You know, the wallet takes too much time, and you know, it's so I think it's too early for mass adoption on that front. I believe that crypto, you know, if you ask me for a prediction, and is that for e-commerce will represent, depending on the merchants, between couple of percent, 1-3, up to maybe 10%. There might be a couple of outliers on that. Obviously, high ticket items were going to have a bit more crypto than others. People doing a lot of cross-border are going to see more usage of crypto. A good example of that is, like, if you're a merchant and you're selling globally, today people, you know, most people in Africa, for instance, it's very difficult for them to have a card. And even if they have a card, because of the security system and the fraud detection system, usually they are being denied. So this means that one of the best next option for them is actually to pay with crypto. So I believe that for some of those use cases, it's going to be making a huge difference.
Organic growth in this part of the market is one of the main things that can help us get out of the narrative sort of self-referential finance and onto being integrated in the real economy and in people's lives. And, you know, it makes me think of things like the adoption of the QR code or the adoption of mobile payments as ramps that took quite a long time, but are now, you know, obvious and integrated into the largest footprints available. I want to switch to your earlier entrepreneurial experience and maybe compare and contrast a bit what you've felt and how it's gone. Can you talk a little bit about your previous company, Thunes, and kind of the journey there? What was the original insight? What were you trying to do, and how that went?
So that's a company I started quite a while ago. I started it in 2007. And the angle I took, so the idea was to do remittances, cross-border payments, especially foreign workers, immigrants who needs to send money back home. And my first my first angle was to do it through by topping up prepaid mobile phone. Back then, you know, I was pure startup, didn't have much money, so I knew I wouldn't be able to get a license and things of this nature. So I felt like, what is the next best thing you can send back home if it's not money? Is to top up the prepaid mobile phone of your relatives. So think of it like $5, $10 worth of prepaid airtime you're able to send to your cousin, to your brother back in the Philippines or in India or in Nigeria. And so that's how I started, by building a network of for sending small values. Average transaction was probably in the vicinity of $10.
Sorry to interrupt. I just want to open this up because it's, you know, obviously fascinating. You had a background in telecoms before, and one of the things that started to emerge is that in addition to being a network of information, sort of almost incidentally, every phone became like a balance sheet of value, a bank account, and it happened to be globally connected. When did you notice that network, because this is an incidental use, like how did that come about and how did it become important to you? How did you realize this was a path to take?
I got the idea. I was once in the Philippines and where like 99% of the people are using prepaid phone. And one of the feature of the telco there was that if you were on the same network, you could exchange credit. So I could lend you credit. I was seeing that, and my previous company was already in the telecom space, and I was doing SMS interconnection. You know, SMS, the thing before WhatsApp, if you still remember. So I was helping someone from Hong Kong to send a text message to the UK and vice versa. And so when I saw that in the Philippines, people were able to exchange those prepaid credits, that's how I got the idea to say, hey, if people are doing it domestically, that's probably a business to do it cross-border, given the number of immigrants, you know, Philippines is sending all over the world. You know, 15% of Philippines' GDP is international remittances. So that's how I started that, by enabling people to send $5 worth of airtime just by sending an SMS.
That's really fascinating. Has that behavior persisted or has it changed?
So as far as I know, there's still plenty of people doing it. But what we, and something I stopped seeing while I was still there, is that we're starting to get competition from actual money through the mobile wallets. As you know, in emerging markets, the first mobile wallets were actually driven by telcos. M-Pesa in Kenya, Orange Money, GCash in the Philippines. And now those mobile wallets are so prevalent and are so easy to use that, you know, the airtime is getting, you know, the competition even for small value transfers. So if you want to send now $10 to Kenya, for instance, it used to be way better to do it through prepaid airtime. And now, because the cost went down so much and because M-Pesa is so prevalent everywhere, it's becoming cheaper to do it as money, in the form of money through M-Pesa, and this has more value anyway.
I can't help but jump around a little bit just because it's a topic that is really tricky and I don't know if there's a clear conclusion, but I want to see if you have an insight. And that is the relationship between the telcos, money, the banks and the card networks, and you know, the technology firms. The observation is just, it's strange. It's kind of bizarre that really different types of players are able to create these money networks, right? That you said, first it was the telcos who were laying the internet or phone connectivity, and they've created the networks to connect people, and then boom, incidentally, you have money on it. You know, in some cases, it's the banks and in interbank cross-border transfers. In some cases, it's mobile wallets, which have now turned into their own point-of-sale terminals and payments gateways and the Venmos and the Apples of the world. And then we've got the crypto rails, which are yet another kind of way to create a network and then put money on it. Do you have any reflections on like what's required or the sequence by which this happens? Like, why was it that the telcos were able to introduce money and value into the system. Why is it that in other geographies, it's, you know, card networks or it's technology companies? Like, having played in a couple of different places in this environment, how do you think about networks, value, and sort of who's positioned to create them?
Really, the telcos had no choice because, that, you know, when you're in a country where people are unbanked, how do you get paid at scale in a convenient way? So that's why they had to come up with this prepaid system, which became a full-fledged wallet. So I don't think this is something they planned. It was a necessity. Otherwise, they would never have been able to sell their service. That's always started with the unbanked. So for instance, I'm sitting on the board of STC Pay, which is in Saudi Arabia, which is the mobile wallet, and now a digital bank, but the mobile wallet of the largest mobile operator in Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia is a fairly rich country. However, there's a lot of foreign workers there, and those guys are pretty unbanked or underbanked. And once again, the telco, STC in this case, they managed to provide wallet with 8 million people in a couple of years. And I believe, like, you know, telcos are really equipped, and they have the trust of managing, you know, high volume transactions, and they are also trusted by their clients.
Interesting. So the way I interpret that is it's very demand driven, where, you know, there's a shape of the market and there's always going to be a type of thing that people need, which is to be able to hold value. And if it's an underbanked or an unbanked population, then basically whoever is there at the time or whoever's positioned with the largest distribution footprint, you know, the opportunity will be there to wrap around it, which is interesting given the crypto space, right? Crypto is trying to fight and displace already existing payment rails. Question for you to kind of wrap it together. You know, when you think back to Thunes and the success that company saw and the path to that success, what did you think were the big levers? You're still in the cross-border payment space and you're trying to get people to adopt a different behavior. You know, what do you think were the big levers in that experience? And do you think they'll translate into what you're trying to build with AAA? Like, do you see the analogy? Do you see some sort of rhyme to that prior experience, or is it a completely new game?
No. There's a lot of things which are very similar. We talked about relationship with banks and other financial institutions. You know, remittance, you know, person-to-person transfer is an activity banks hate, and, you know, maybe as much, if not more, than crypto. So all the experience I had to deal with, you know, in terms of compliance and understanding what they need to be able to work with us has been really helpful. So I think there's a lot of similarities into that. I think the other similarity of things I've learned is because I've been working so much with emerging markets, I understand their needs, and I really see crypto as the way for, in particular for businesses, professionals, to get financially included at the global level. I would say now, thanks to the mobile wallets, the M-Pesa, the Bcash of this world, way more people are banked and so on. However, they don't have access to the global financial economy. I am a freelancer in Bangladesh. I'm lucky to find a client from Europe or from the US. I'm going to get my US dollar. I'm going to be forced into the local currency, into Bangladeshi taka, which then I cannot move out. So that's not really fair. So the beauty of crypto, that for the first time ever, it enables anyone on the planet to have a USD account, or I would say more generally a strong currency account, no matter where you are. And while today, if you're a small business in Kenya, it's impossible to have a USD bank account. And crypto is solving that.
That's certainly inspirational. And I hope you're right. I hope that's exactly what we see. To your earlier point, the 400 million people that hold crypto assets, the something like 500 million addresses on Ethereum and Web3. I mean, to me, those are really bright signals. And I'm encouraged that in the e-commerce space, we've got company like yours plugging that value into the real world economy. Eric, thank you so much for joining me today. If our listeners want to learn more about you or about AAA, where should they go?
They can go to my LinkedIn, Eric Barbier, or I'm happy to connect. And I'm always happy to answer questions. And you can go on AAA.io as our website.
Fantastic. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Lex.
Hi, everyone. That's it for this week's episode of the FinTech Blueprint. For more technical deep dives into all things fintech and decentralized finance, check out fintechblueprint.com and grab a free subscription to the newsletter. This is Lex, and I'll see you next time.